clutch of the sky. Barton raised his face in the peering, sniffing, jocular way he had. "Well," he said after some moments, "whether this quashy has got pox or whatever it is, we can't take him. We would have the whole shipload shedding their skins before we get sight of Kingston. And one of them boys is too young, not more than 9 or 10 by the look of him. The captain won't take him so young, on account of they needs extra looking after, and then generally dies anyway. So, that leaves the 2 women. The procedure with these was the same as for the men, except that they were made to lie down on their backs and open their legs for the more convenient inspection of the genital parts, a spectacle arousing much ribald comment from the crew, though there were those who observed it in silence, and 1 or 2 who, with feelings of uneasiness they might not have recognised for compassion, contrived, though inconspicuously, not to look closely on. The woman was full-breasted, with high muscular haunches and slender legs. Pushed down to the deck, she yielded to the gross inspection, merely turning her head to the side and laying an arm over her eyes. The girl uttered some sounds of no more meaning to the men around her than the cries of gulls, and she stiffened involuntarily against the pressure of Paris's fingers. Her arms had to be held, or she would have covered herself. This agony of resistance was brief. With surrender, the girl's body collapsed into inertness on the deck, though her eyes remained open and fixed as she stared directly upwards.
"Nice bit of flesh, this one."
Barton flicked his fingers at the small nipples with casual brutality.
"Hot little bitch, too, I expect, when she gets over this. Like all of them. But I'd rather rattle the older one. I like a mature. They knows more tricks. Not that there'll be much joy on this voyage, not if I know anything. Not without paying for it with the skin off your back. With Furzo, it is hands off or a flogging. Our skipper takes a moral line with women slaves."
Before Paris could inform himself further as to this, the captain himself reappeared from below with King Henry by his side. They reseated themselves under the awning, where the king's motley entourage once more assembled around him.
"More brandy for our guests,"
Thurso said briskly. Paris had not seen him before in such festive mood.
"Morgan!" he shouted. "Damn you! Look alive! Serve it out! Mr. Barton, I want you by my side here. Haynes, go and see to the fire. I want them branded as soon as purchased."
"There are 3 we don't take, sir," Barton said. "There is the woman and a boy who's too young, and one of the men who our doctor will give you a full report of when you are more at leisure, but it looks like a case of Spanish pox to me."
"I want them off the ship," Thurso said. "Then go back down over the side." "Tat, tat, sir," he said, turning to Yellow Henry. "You think Thurso go by pox, man?"
The king was looking graver now, though squinting slightly as a result of the liquor.
"You no got green bufty stuff," he said. "I very sorry about that. You got blue, you got red, you no got green."
He shook his head sadly from side to side.
"I hoping for green," he said. "Plenty trade for green bufties. You no got sletters neither. That bad, Captain Thurso. Plenty trade silk sletter stuff."
Thurso nodded. He had expected that the mulatto would start with complaints. It was always what you hadn't got that they claimed most to want, but he had noted the scornfully cursory way Yellow Henry had glanced at the pans and kettles and the gilt-framed looking-glasses. It was these he really wanted, not bafts or chintzes. And muskets, probably. Without arms, they could not make forays for slaves.
"For that tall fellow there, I make you bargain," he said. "I give you 55 bar for that one."
Yellow Henry's broad face, liberally moistened now and resinous-looking, sagged into lines of disbelief. He pressed a large palm, the colour of dark butter, against his nose in an apparent attempt to flatten it further.
"That prime slave and first-class characker," he said, when he had to some extent recovered from his surprise. "He Mandingo people. Price all along this coast, 62 bar for prime man-slave." "Come now," Thurso said. "We both sabby dat too high. I can't go above 57. How you make up 1 bar? What you go give me make up 1 bar? I make you 2 pound gunpowder, 1 bar. I make you 1 pound fringe, 1 bar. I make you 1 ounce silver, 1 bar. And you make it dashy, put to that. I make dashy 6 pewter tankards with each slave." "No take tankards," Yellow Henry said sullenly. "You tankards trash.
They got no handles.
His temper seemed to be deteriorating.
I take dashi 2 brass kettles, he said.
Suddenly he started forward. His eyes rolled fearfully and his hand went to the hilt of his cutlass.
Keep that man back, he said.
What the devil is it?
Thurzo turned sharp round.
Where are your wits, Haynes? He said. Keep our people back.
Callie, either curious to see more closely what was taking place, or in eagerness to get within touching distance of the women, had blundered too near.
Stand clear, you clodpole,
Haynes snarled. Annoyed at being found wanting, he struck backhanded at Callie, catching him across the cheek.
Do you want to start them shooting? He said.
Paris, leaning back against the gunwale, taking deep breaths of air, observed the bemused and rather frightened expression on Callie's face, as if from a great distance. He felt remote from the proceedings now, like an accidental bystander, and strangely open to the space of the world beyond the ship, swept, blown through with it. At the same time, he was intensely aware of his physical being, aware of thirst, of his lungs breathing, of his hands, in which he still seemed to feel the warmth and shape of the woman's knees. In his hands, too, not yet acknowledged in his heart, the throb of lust and jubilation he had felt at her abandonment. He ceased after a while to follow the bargaining, which was extremely complicated. To establish the value of the slave in bars, which he had thought at first to be the whole purpose of the proceedings, was in fact only the beginning. This bar, it seemed, was merely a value given to a certain quantity of goods. It could be half a gallon of brandy, or a bag of shot, or 2 dozen flints, or a length of printed cotton. It was in order to obtain small concessions and adjustments in these values that Thurzo and Yellow Henry, facing each other in their respective hats, wheedled and blustered and simulated mirth or astonishment or disgust. The tall negro whom Paris had examined first was purchased finally for 6 brass kettles, 2 cabers of cowries, 4 silver-laced cocked hats, 25 looking-glasses, and an anchor of brandy, with a bonus of 6 folding knives and a plumed hat offered by Thurzo for the goodwill of the king's trade. As soon as the deal was struck and the goods brought up, the man was dragged forward into the waist of the ship, where the branding irons had been heating all this while in the brazier. Some fixity of the will kept Paris gazing after them. The slave was concealed from view by the men holding him down, but Paris saw the equable second mate, Simmons, take out the bar, saw him hold it up and spit on the red-hot device at the tip, caught for a moment against the white hull of the yawl beyond, the glowing, angular design of the brand mark. It was the letter K. Simmons' face wore a look of concentration, a recognition of the need for accuracy, which suddenly recalled to Paris his student days, assisting at dissections. Almost for a moment, even now, it seemed that he might find some retreat in the memory of those days, the intense circle of students clustered round the table in the lamplight, the precise and somehow stealthy approach of the knife to the cadaver. Faces, too, there were, in this present circle, which showed signs of distress, like those novice anatomists of long ago. He saw Blair's face, marked still from his fighting, staring down with jaws rigidly set. The tall, dishevelled fiddler had a similar fixity of expression. These men briefly aided Paris, abetted the illusion. But from a living man, not a drained simulacrum, the sound that came now, the single cry from below, throat-formed and pure, he saw the brief tension in the group of men holding the negro down. Barber, with the boy Charlie to help him, moved forward with the shackles for the legs. A smell of burned flesh hung in the air. My uncle has acquired his first slave, Paris thought. Through what seemed still the ripples of the cry, he heard Yellow Henry's voice raised in a tone more plaintive than angry.
For why you no got green bafties? For why you tankards no got handles?
Bargaining had commenced over the second negro.
Stow that palaver,
Thurzo said, leaning back with affected carelessness.
You take dashi 2 brass pan?
Man here no want saucepans. They say you saucepans trash.
We got muskets, made Brummagan.
Muskets! Ho ho!
Yellow Henry raised a face distorted with false mirth.
We know you muskets, he said.
The men around him laughed in a whooping chorus. It was death, of course, that made the difference, Paris told himself carefully, as if reciting a lesson. You can work your will on a dead body. Those laid out for dissection had been men and women dying destitute, stolen from paupers' graves, or criminals cut down from the gallows, with no rights whatsoever over the disposal of themselves in death and in life. As he stood there, the distinction grew blurred in his mind. Was there really so much difference? Glancing up, he saw Hughes high in the cross-trees of the foremast, white seabirds wheeling beyond him. From so high above, what must this business seem like? What sense could someone unacquainted with the trade have made of it? Too far away to smell the scorched flesh. A brief contortion of the face, which might have betokened laughter or even merely dazzlement. A cry, thinned out to a voice of the wind. And all the while these goods steadily piling up on the quarter-deck, shining kettles and pans, cut-glass beads, the jumble of vividly coloured cloths. From the perspective of the cross-trees, inexplicable, unless you knew. From the office where his uncle sat, even the mystery was gone from it, reduced to an entry in a ledger. Banks of white cloud were building to the west. The sun struck through them in shafts of silver. Paris stood against the rail on the weather side of the ship, taking advantage of what breeze there was. The boy went for 35 bars, the last of the males to be sold. He began to cry out as soon as he was seized, and screamed repeatedly while he was branded. Afterwards he wept, with an isolated and persistent sobbing in which there seemed all childish heartbreak and loss. It was not even this, however, but a kind of joke about the muskets, which finally drove Paris below. In the course of bargaining for the female slaves, Thurzo had ordered 2 cases of muskets to be brought up on deck. One had been opened to show the oiled barrels. He was hoping to seduce Yellow Henry with the sight, having been privately surprised that the other had not so far made any mention of firearms. The mulatto's rule depended on his ability to reward his followers, which in turn depended on his ability to maintain a supply of slaves for the visiting ships. This he did, as Thurzo knew, by fomenting small wars in the interior and sending raiding parties to make captives in the confusion. It was a profitable trade, and the mulatto had rivals. Thurzo knew of several. The more men Yellow Henry could enlist to his cause, the safer he was. But recruits had to be attracted with the promise of muskets.
See, Thurzo said, pointing at the cases. These first-class muskets. Brummagan goods. Look, here, it is printed on the case.
He pointed to the black stenciling on the lid. Yellow Henry sighed and rolled his eyes disdainfully. He barely deigned to follow the direction of Thurzo's pointed finger. He was not a proficient reader in any case.
Last time, all same-same, he said. Brumgem trash place, musket no good.
His face fell suddenly into an expression of angry truculence.
We buy Dutchy musket, he said.
Dutch muskets?
Thurzo was clearly scandalized at this.
English workmanship is the best in the world, he said.
Despite his attempt at equanimity, some rage had crept into his face and voice at the insult. Yellow Henry appeared to meditate for some moments, stretching his mouth and distending his nostrils in an expression half-savage, half-humorous. His face glistened. Some quality of stillness had invested the men flanking him.
"Brumgen muskets, take off my finger!"
he said at last, apparently deciding to make a joke of it. He pouted and puffed explosively into the air, blinking rapidly and raising a hand to follow the track of his breath.
"Goodbye, finger!"
he said. There was laughter at this among his men. He turned his heavy shoulders to look round at them.
"Show them Brumgen musket!"
he said. 2 of the men, smiling radiantly, raised their right hands. Each had a forefinger missing, and one had lost also the first joint of his thumb. At the sight, there was a whooping clamour of merriment from the king's retainers. Yellow Henry himself was overcome by laughter. When he looked up, there were thick tears in his eyes.
"Why are you laughing?" he said. "Why you make big eye? De lucky, so good hands!"
Paris looked from the grinning faces to the mutilated hands. It seemed suddenly swelteringly hot, as if the clouds had hushed the wind. A sensation of nausea came to him, like the onset of some long-suspected disease. Taking advantage of the general release of tension in the wake of Yellow Henry's joke, he passed down onto the main deck, where the slaves, already branded and shackled, were grouped together, and thence to his cabin. Once there, he bathed face and neck and hands in the water it was Charlie's duty to fetch for him each day. He tried not to smell it, as it had become malodorous with this long time in the butts, but it was blessedly cool. The nausea receded. In an attempt to reach some degree of the detachment he felt was needed now to save him, he had his usual recourse to Harvey, turning quickly through the pages until his eye was arrested at the celebrated argument from quantity, the first of its kind in the history of physiology. The heart, in 1/2 hour, makes above 1,000 pulses. Indeed, in certain men, and at certain times, 2, 3, or 4,000. Now, if the drams be multiplied, it will be seen that in 1/2 hour there is a greater quantity of blood passed through the heart into the arteries than can be found in the whole body. But for once, Harvey failed to provide solace. It was too closely argued, too logical. It resembled too much what was happening on deck at that moment. Thurzo and Yellow Henry were using the argument from quantity too, and every whit as rigorously. Perhaps he needed some more personal and passionate statement. He opened his volume of Pope and began to read at random. As man, perhaps the moment of his breath receives the lurking principle of death, the young disease that must subdue at length grows with his growth and strengthens with his strength. So, cast and mingled with his very frame, the mind's disease, its ruling passion, came. This was beautiful, but too measured for him in his present disturbed state, too neat in its elegant contrivance of the rhymes and precise balancing of analogies. He abandoned it in favour of Astley's collection of travellers' accounts of Africa. "They have continual war against dragons, which desire their blood, because it is very cold, and therefore the dragon, lying await as the elephant passeth by, windeth his tail, being of exceeding length, about the hinder legs of the elephant, and so staying him, thrusteth his head into his trunk, and exhausteth his breath. When the elephant waxeth faint, he falleth down on the serpent, being now full of blood, and with the poise of his body breaketh him." He continued to read with obstinate attentiveness, through the cries that came to him as the women were branded, through the prolonged and cacophonous fanfares of Yellow Henry's departure. Then there was an hour with only the faint washing of the waves for sound. He read of the inhabitants of Guinea, a people of beastly living, without a god, law, religion, or commonwealth, and so scorched and vexed with the heat of the sun that in many places they curse it when it riseth. He read of the Queen of Sheba, who went to Jerusalem to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and of Prester John and the peoples of the interior of Africa, the satyrs who resemble men only in shape, the troglodytes who dwell in caves and live on the flesh of serpents, and the Blemines, a people without heads, who have their eyes and mouth in their breast. At a change of watch, Charlie came knocking at his door with a request from the captain for his presence up on deck. He went up to a spectacular sunset, with great rafts of fire smouldering among the dark ash of the cloud. Thurzo was on the quarter-deck already, standing at the forward rail, with Barton and Simmons behind him. The crew were mustering below on the after-deck. Paris mounted by the companion ladder and took up a position some yards from the first mate. The slaves were sitting in the waist, the men chained, the women and the girl free. As soon as the men were assembled, Thurzo began speaking directly down to them in his hoarse, barely inflected voice. They had taken their first slaves on board. Any man who had sailed on a slaver would know that now the real business had begun. They had all been on a holiday before. Now they would start to earn their wages. Negroes were valuable merchandise. Every care had to be taken to make sure that each slave purchased was delivered in first-rate condition, so as to fetch best prices at Kingston Market. They were to be kept under constant watch while on deck, to prevent them from jumping overboard or doing themselves some other mischief. Any man found sleeping on watch could be sure of a dozen lashes for the first offence, doubled for the second.
"I will not have the negroes damaged," he said.
Rage at the notion whitened his knuckles as he gripped the rail before him.
"By God," he said, "the man will be damaged who tries it, I promise you. He will wish he had never been born. Use of the short whip against him is permitted to all members of crew for purposes of making him move and keeping him in order, but I will not have him cut or struck about the eyes or mouth."
Relaxing his attention somewhat, Paris looked to seaward, where that first fiery splendour of the sunset was softening now to drifts of dusky, luminous gold. The sky to the east, empty of cloud, was a single bright bruise of violet and rose, draining on the horizon, above the darkening line of forest, to the colder blue of night. The plunge and crash of the surf still sounded without abatement. The spray showed a dim radiance of watered blood before it rose and was lost in twilight.
"One more thing," Thurzo said. "On no account will there be fornication with the women. I will have no foulness of that sort aboard my ship. Any man found lying with a female slave will be first flogged and then stapled down to the deck, and I will know of it, never fear, because I am purposing to bring a linguister aboard tomorrow who will understand the language of these people. We will be trading ashore in the longboat in these next days. What you do ashore is your own business. I will not have my cargo damaged, I tell you, and I will not have my ship turned into a sink of iniquity. A girl still intact is worth a good 10 guineas more in Jamaica. Which man of you will step forward now and put 10 guineas into my hand?"
There was silence from the men below. Thurzo raised his face to the darkening sky.
"I made my promises long ago," he said, "before most of you men were born. That is why I'm still here talking to you. I will keep a clean ship while I live."
Part 5, Chapter 25. The departure of Adams and subsequent collapse of the rehearsals brought happier days for Erasmus. He became an accepted visitor at the Walpert home. His handsome, glowering silences, the evident force of his attachment, had ended by disposing Sarah's mother towards him, had even, in some degree, if not softened the father's heart, at any rate relaxed his severity. Walpert did not like the young man any better for being in love with his daughter, rather the contrary. Strong-willed and proprietorial himself, he found these qualities difficult to stomach in another, and the saving irony which he was sometimes able to direct at himself was a quality his prospective son-in-law showed not a glimpse of. Moreover, with that perceptiveness he had for all concerning his daughter, Walpert noted still the oppressive effect on her of the young man's visits, the way he seemed to overshadow the girl, to work a reduction of brightness in her. Nevertheless, dimmed or not, she sought to be with him. She went running to meet him. It was clear to Walpert that his daughter wanted Erasmus Kemp, and he could no more refuse her this than anything else she had ever wanted that had been in his power to grant. So, without any official change in his position or status, Erasmus was allowed to visit, to walk with Sarah and talk to her, alone sometimes for short periods, more often with someone in discreet attendance, generally an unmarried second cousin of Sarah's mother, a Miss Purdy, who lived in the house. His nature expanded with this sense of occupying a privileged position. He talked much and confidently about the future, their future, when they were married, and that of the city, which he saw as intimately connected.
"Transport and the carriage trade," he would pronounce with glowing eyes.
They were words of love and promise, containing all that he meant to work for, all that he would offer her.
"That is where the future lies. Money is flooding into Liverpool, more every day. The best use that money can be put to is extending the docks, cutting new canals, improving the roads so as to give better access to us from the interior of the country."
The fervour sprang from a source not altogether pure. On his father's instructions, he had been buying up a good deal of land bordering the approach roads to Liverpool. The value of this would increase dramatically with the sort of development he was hoping for. But his enthusiasm was due only partly to this. The idealism of his nature was roused by thoughts of material progress. He saw a beautiful and prosperous city rising. Liverpool would be the greatest port in the land, greater than London. She would take over the Atlantic trade. All the manufacturing wealth of Lancashire would flow through her. Walpert, he knew, had interests in coal and in the Cheshire salt mines. Taken with a Kemp shipping and import business, it made a formidable combination. The future, he thus envisaged, was a palace of marble, and Sarah was queen of it, enclosed within securely his own. About the present, he could never feel this confidence. The present was curiously porous. It had no containment. Things leaked away from him in all directions. Sarah's affections were offered too widely. They extended beyond her family, to friends, servants, even her pets. There was no end to it. In the presence of others, among people who had knowledge of her out of his reach, he was never at ease. He took greater pains than ever with his person and his clothes, and was agreed among Sarah's acquaintance to be well-favoured enough, but disobliging and too proud. One habit of hers, first noticed during the rehearsals for the Enchanted Isle, troubled him greatly, and he was resolved to eradicate it as soon as he had acquired the authority of a husband. She had a luminous way of recounting, or confiding, he knew not what to call it, a way of commanding attention when talking in a group by spacing out her words rather deliberately and punctuating them with small climaxes. She would say, "That was a great disappointment to everyone," or "I simply adore strawberries," and she would raise her face and smile slightly, and just for a second her eyes would close and there would pass over her a sort of slight shudder or pang, like the faintest of pleasurable spasms. Those around her, and especially the men, as it seemed to Erasmus, were held enthralled to her as they first awaited, then sympathetically shared these climactic moments. It was charming, no doubt, but there was something unseemly in it, to Erasmus's view. It might be permissible in an unmarried girl, and one who had been much indulged, too much, he sometimes thought these days, but it would not do for a wife, who, after all, is guardian of her husband's dignity. He would have liked to speak to her immediately about it, but hesitated to do so, being afraid that she would misunderstand his motives. She was wilful, and did not take kindly to correction. But he was resolved to make his views plain to her when they were married. Small resolves of this sort were mixed inextricably with his larger ambitions for the future. Finding himself unable to control the present, as he could the future, by excluding anything unpalatable, he tried to do it by grasping for the essence of Sarah's life before he had appeared in it. He would question her in a painstaking fashion, but his questions always failed to elicit what he sought, and any information she herself volunteered was somehow unmanageable. Her catechism dress, a pet pug, visits to Chester with her mother, his mind could not work on these things, he could not take them over. Trying to imagine a past for her, a separate existence, a time when he was not present, this was as painful and difficult as trying to be Ferdinand to her Miranda, and in fact, not much dissimilar. What came more easily to him was a sort of appropriation. He was happiest when he could take her experience and reinterpret it for her. One morning in early August, when they had arranged to go riding together, as he was waiting for her in a small room adjacent to the salon, his eye fell on a painting hanging there, set in an elaborate scroll-gilt frame. It was a picture of a landscape, with lords and ladies in fashionable dress of some former period. The men were handsome and proud, the ladies slender and exquisite. Accompanied by servants and long-legged, elegant hounds, they strolled through orchards where fruit glowed among dark leaves, and the turf beneath their feet was spangled with white flowers. Erasmus gazed for some time at the painting, struck by the sense of serene enjoyment contained in it. It was obviously old. The pigments had thickened and darkened, and the glaze showed through here and there. But there was a brightness still about the faces of these fashionable strollers. They had a charmed, invulnerable air, as if blessings were raining invisibly down through the strangely rounded, clump-shaped trees. When Sarah came in, dressed for riding in a dark green habit, he asked her where the painting had come from. "It belonged to my mother's family, I believe, so I've heard tell." "You're not sure?" He smiled, thinking it odd that she should be vague about such a thing. He knew the exact provenance of every article in his own house. "It has been here for as long as I remember," she said, with something defensive now in her tone. "Always in the same place. Do you not know who painted it?" "I've no idea. Is that so strange?" "When it is known who painted the picture, the value of it may thereby increase," Erasmus said this rather loudly and sententiously, secure in his greater knowledge of affairs. Value? Sarah arched her brows at him as if in some surprise. She paused a moment, then said, "If I ever knew the name of the painter, I forgot it. It will be some foreign man who lived long ago. I do not know how it is titled, either. I mean, what he called it. But I do know what it is about." Erasmus recognized the distinctness with which she uttered these last words, and the luminous smile that came now to her face. With absolute certainty, she said, "It is a picture of people in paradise." And for the briefest of moments, her eyelids flickered together, and the slightest of shudders went through her. For a short while, Erasmus considered her gravely. Then he looked back at the painting, but with a sharper and more deliberate attentiveness now. "Paradise?" he said after some moments of scrutiny. "Who has servants in paradise? Those are servants, aren't they?"
"No, no,"
she said quickly and somehow urgently, as if a word in time now could prevent serious misunderstanding. "No, people would see it in the light of their own lives. If you have servants while you are alive, you would naturally think of having them in paradise, too. I've known this picture all my life. It used to fascinate me when I was a little girl, the expression on their faces. They are in paradise. You see how blessed they are. Nothing can touch them. They command everything." She had spoken volubly, and with the same note of urgency, a tone almost of pleading, childish and insistent. Erasmus looked at her with the same deliberateness with which she had regarded the painting. His face wore an expression she had never seen on it before, patronizing and almost contemptuous. "And dogs," he said, "and fine clothes. Those are hunting dogs, you know. Do folk go hunting in paradise?" In her expression now, as she looked at him, there was a kind of bewilderment. "But I've explained that to you," she said. "People have to see things in their own way. If it is happiness on earth to wear beautiful clothes and be at leisure, then they think it must be the same in heaven, too. Explained it to me." Erasmus was smiling still, but his eyes had narrowed. He said, "I believe you see yourself as one of those fashionable ladies, Sarah, don't you? That must be why you like the picture so much. You think paradise is a place to dress up and act a part in. It is like being on a stage, isn't it? Like the Enchanted Isle." "That is not how I feel at all. It is just the contrary," she said, regarding him more narrowly. "I always felt that they were in another world from mine. That is why..."
"No," he said. "That is what you may think you felt, but it is not the truth of the matter. Children make up stories. You must always have known it was really just a picture of people walking about in a garden, but you made up a story about them. I tell you, Sarah, I know you better than you know yourself."
The shaft of perception had restored his good humour. He gestured towards the painting.
"These are just people walking about in a garden," he said. "If you'll only look properly at the picture, you'll see that I'm right."
Turning back towards her, he was surprised to encounter a face set against him, blue eyes that looked antagonism.
"Well, well, what a long time I've been mistaken," she said, in the tone of angry sarcasm with which she nearly always began quarrels. "And just imagine, I might have continued in error if one fine morning Erasmus Kemp hadn't condescended to take a look and tell me what opinion I ought to have, which of course turns out to be just exactly the same as his. In fact, it seems I've always been of his opinion, really, but without knowing it."
She had begun steadily enough, but her voice quivered now.
"You don't know me at all," she said. "You don't see me as I am. When you say what I am like, I don't recognize myself. You don't want me to have anything of my own. You don't want me to have anything to give you. You're not in the least bit interested in the painting."
"Not interested?" Erasmus repeated slowly. He could not understand what she meant. He was hurt and astonished at this resistance to his knowledge of her. It was like a rejection of his love.
"Sarah, consider a moment," he said. "Reflect on what you say. Can people not discuss an old painting together?"
He drew himself up and looked at her with a sort of gloomy remonstrance.
"If we are to fall out over small things, how shall we agree on the great ones?"
This was, he felt, an important question, and one she should have tried to answer. However, she said nothing. She kept her face still turned from him. The ride together did not promise well, and they might have decided against it, had not Miss Purdy, dressed and ready, now put in an appearance. If she saw anything amiss between them, she did not remark on it. The morning was fine, and she was looking forward to a ride. It was a day of pale sunshine and light cloud. They rode together in silence, through meadows thick with vetch and buttercups and clover. Sarah in front, then Erasmus, prey to conflict still, dignity preventing him from riding alongside, love from falling too far behind. Miss Purdy kept further back on her stout, short-legged mare. Unhappiness in Erasmus was compounded with resentment. She had been perverse and unjust, he felt. Was he not allowed an opinion? To be misappreciated is never one's own fault. It must therefore be Sarah's if he had failed to demonstrate his true worth. He wanted her to see that it had been a disinterested quest for truth that had led him to discuss the painting with her. She expected still the indulgence accorded to children. He had shown her the respect of treating her as an adult. That was all his offence. He marshalled this in his mind as he rode along. He knew it to be true by the infallible sign that the alternative to thinking so involved self-reproach. He had never been much given to introspection. He knew what he wanted, and that was motive and reason enough. He knew he wanted to marry Sarah Walpert. He knew he wanted to be rich. Some deep unease, something akin to fear, would come to him at any attempt, whether made by himself or others, to root about below the level of his conscious will. Virtue lay in achievement. It was this that, since early childhood, had led him to sanctify his desires by taking them to the high altar of his room and giving them the form of solemn promises. Their way wound upwards, at first through strands of mixed woodland, then out into more open country. After some half hour, as they approached a point where the bridle path curved round a low spur, Sarah turned in her saddle to glance briefly over her shoulder at Erasmus, then urged her mount into a trot. He followed suit, as it was clear he was intended to, and found her reining in broadside across the track at the far side of the spur. She looked at him with the expression of conspiratorial glee he had come to recognise and rejoice in. They had achieved by this stratagem a minute or two out of sight of Miss Purdy. He had the grace at once to realise that with generosity greater than his own, she had contrived this occasion for them both. He saw, too, almost as quickly, that though an exchange of smiles might have been enough for reconciliation, a kiss would be considerably better. He urged his mount forward. The two horses drew close, rubbed hot flanks together, and their riders leaned forward in the saddle and kissed with a warmth, the more eager for the fact that they could touch nowhere but at the lips. Other kisses there had been between them during the foregoing weeks, but in the isolation of this moment, the overwhelming sense of love restored and faults forgiven, Erasmus seemed for some moments to achieve the dream of containment he was always pursuing. Sky and land formed a bubble of thin crystal shot through with light, and he and Sarah were caught and held in it beyond the touch of change. It came with a shock, almost, as he drew away from her and the walls of their bright capsule dissolved, to find himself exposed again to the touch of air, the world of colours, the attention, possibly reproachful, of the approaching chaperone. "I am sorry I hurt your feelings," Sarah said in low, quick tones. "I did not mean to." Love does not stand still, as everyone knows. It is always adding to its own shape, whether by advance or retreat. Wounds can be absorbed, but only like elements embodied in a story. They are always there, part of the meaning. Sarah was spirited, quick to resent wrongs and slights, to herself or any creature she was attached to, but no resentment could last long with her. She did not bear grudges. Nevertheless, she was accustomed to kindness, especially in her home. She would always remember the look that had come to Erasmus's face when she had confided the meaning of the picture to him, and she would always know that she had been treated with cruelty that morning. As for Erasmus, even while, in the moments before Miss Purdy came up with them, he was assuring Sarah that he loved her more than anything in the world, somewhere within him he was registering a private displeasure at the terms of her apology. This too, though vague at the time, was destined to take root in the formal garden of his future resolves. It had been right for her to ask his pardon, but not for the hurt she had given him. That was neither here nor there. Wounded feelings did not matter, but there was a principle at stake.
Her apology still left unresolved the important question of whose fault it had been. She should acknowledge that she had been wrong about the picture. Perhaps some day, he thought, there would be an opportunity for him to return to the question. The present moment was clearly not appropriate. But she was fond of the painting, and when they were married it might quite possibly be one of the things from home that she would want to bring with her. With Charles Walpert, he was quite often at loggerheads these days. There had been a certain coolness between them since the abrupt end to rehearsals of The Enchanted Isle. Charles largely blamed Erasmus for this fiasco, even to the extent of privately holding him responsible for Caliban's defection as well, though the unhappy curate had long since explained to them the real reason. Moreover, he could not forgive Erasmus the lesser majesty of waylaying a Walpert guest on Walpert ground. There were, besides, temperamental differences between the two young men, which would probably have led to disagreement in any case. Charles had his father's physical bulk and gravity of address, but little of his business acumen. He was diligent and conscientious, and sought to conceal his chronic irresolution behind a manner that grew daily more magisterial. Erasmus, possessed by the twin ardours of love and ambition, and with a vision of the towers of Liverpool rising lovelier than those fabled ones of Ilium, besides offering much better rates of compound interest, grew impatient with the cautious and legalistic habit of Charles's mind, and with his long-windedness. One afternoon, when Erasmus was taking tea in company with Sarah and her mother, Charles returned from the courts in considerable ill-humour, and proceeded to complain at length about the protracted course of some litigation the family were involved in, which his father had made him responsible for. As Erasmus knew, there had been recent acts of Parliament seeking to limit damage to the roads by restricting the number of horses to the wagon and the breadth of the tyres of the wagon wheels. The Walperts were seeking a ruling on permitted loads per wagon, and it was taking an unconscionable time, according to Charles.
They talk about horses, they talk about wheels, but they won't come round to the question of loads, he said. It is exasperating in the highest degree.
He had taken to wearing a curled wig lately, which increased the resemblance to his father. He was booted still from riding, having entered in haste for his tea and the sympathetic attention of his mother and sister. It had not much pleased him to find Erasmus ensconced there. He sat back, frowning, legs stretched out before him, thumbs looped into his waistcoat pockets. It was a pose Erasmus recognised as the prelude to a great deal of tedious prosing.
"If we could only get a ruling on it, you see," Charles said, "we might then be able to turn the tables, as we could retort upon them that with loads of that order it is nonsense to forbid extra horses, or they will simply burst their hearts between the shafts. If we can once carry that point, we might be able to press for a change in the regulations concerning the wagon wheels. But these lawyers talk endlessly, and they get nothing done, and charge confounded high fees."
Erasmus had felt antagonism merely at the way Charles sprawled there, the space he took up, and then these tedious and pointless squabbles over pack trains.
"Wrangling in the courts is a waste of time," he said. "You'll take 6 months over it, and get an inch or two added to the width of the wheels. For the life of me, I cannot see what good that will do. Your costs are not thereby much reduced. The amounts you can transport are not much increased, and the roads remain in the same state, all ruts in the dry weather and streaming with mud when it rains. It is the roads that need attention, not the wagon wheels."
These remarks, and the manner of their delivery, were irritating to Charles, who had been embroiled in the business for some time now, and so felt entitled to be listened to, especially on his home ground.
"It is no use trying to run before you can walk," he said. "That is a besetting fault of yours, Erasmus, if I may say so. The coal is lying there in the coal fields. It is needed now, today. We have to bring it on the roads we have got. What do you think will be the consequence to our salt works if we let the coal pile up 30 miles away while we wait for this utopia of yours?"
"I'm not talking about utopias." Erasmus's eyes had kindled. "I am talking about known facts. The road between Liverpool and Prescott was metalled and tolls charged for the upkeep, and that led to vastly improved supplies of coal from the southwest. Now they have extended it to St. Helens, and in time they—"
"It is time my son is talking about." For some moments, the heated Erasmus could not quite determine where this gentle female voice had come from.
had seemed to fall on his ears from some unlocalized source somewhere up towards the ceiling. Then, with intense surprise, he realized that it was Sarah's mother who had spoken. In her mob cap and lace shawl, Mrs. Walpert had leaned forward and actually interrupted him. "That road was turnpiked more than 25 years ago," she continued placidly. "That is before you were born, Erasmus. I remember it well. It happened in the year I was married. It has taken all these years just to carry the road on to St. Helens, in spite of all the great advantages you speak of. I hope you don't mean to say that my husband has to sit 20 years and wait for better roads while they make their laws against them in London." Erasmus could find no immediate response to this. He had felt his jaw slacken with astonishment. Never in his whole life had he heard a woman intrude her opinion into a conversation on business matters between men. It was inconceivable that his own mother should ever do so. Walpert must permit it, he thought, divided between wonder and contempt. Perhaps he even consulted her. Her tone had betokened intimacy with her husband's affairs. No wonder Sarah was so ready with opinion, with this model before her eyes. "No, madam," he said at last, staring straight before him. "I did not mean to suggest that. How your husband fetches his coal to Liverpool is entirely his own affair." The reproof rankled long afterwards as a setback, a blow to his self-esteem, made worse by the vindicated complacency that he had seen come to Charles's face. But when he was alone and safe from such pettifogging objections, when he was at home, or riding to and from the Walpert house, or occupied with family business, his mind expanded with a sense of the glorious opportunities the future afforded, and the certainty of his place in it, his and Sarah's. Coal was the key. So far, Walpert was right. The population of the town was more than 20,000 now, and rising rapidly, and the domestic demand for coal was rising with it. In Cheshire, the boiling of brine and refining of rock salt called for coal in ever larger quantities, as did the other new industries springing up on every hand. Metalworking, glassmaking, sugar refining, all were hungry for coal, and all were obliged to use the port of Liverpool to ship their goods. It was clear to Erasmus that wagon trains could never bring the quantities needed, even if the roads were improved. The coal would have to come by water. Already, the Mersey was navigable by small ships as far as Manchester, and the barges were plying back and forth from Stockport. This had been achieved in the teeth of scoffing unbelievers by deepening and strengthening the river channels. A great feat of engineering. They had reconstructed the river, no less. The skills thus learned could be, must inevitably be, and soon, applied to man-made waterways, which would carry a vastly greater tonnage at a fraction of the cost. Erasmus felt energy course through him at the thought. His imagination might remain untouched by Ferdinand weeping for the king his father's rack, or Sarah clinging to a cherished notion of childhood, but it became incandescent at thoughts of transporting 100,000 tons of coal a year in your own barges. The future lay in coalfields and canals. He knew it. Beyond any shadow of question, the men who gained control of these would be the new princes of the city, eminent, powerful, rich beyond the dreams of avarice. He was happy during these summer weeks. It was to be, in his recollection, a golden time, instinct with a promise and hope that he sensed at many different moments of his day, at home in his room or on the streets of the city or at work, where, in addition to the duties normally falling to him, he was responsible now for all the coastal shipping business of the firm and for the movement of raw cotton to Warrington and Manchester, he was applying himself diligently to the study of accountancy and mercantile law. The season seemed to contain the same promise. It was full tide of green now in the hedges and waste ground on the outskirts of the city, where herons flapped above the marshes, and cows grazed, and vagrants slept in the long grass among the brick kilns. The willow herb came, and the berries began to redden on the rowan trees. The meadows were scythed, the grass lying in long, slightly darker swathes. The slopes of the hills and the edges of the wheat fields echoed to the stuttering song of the yellowhammer with its mournfully protracted final note. Then the birds fell silent, and the stubble lay crepitant and hot, emitting odours of slightly stale sweetness. Summer reached its apogee and began insensibly to wane, and it would have no more been possible to say when this waning began than it would have been to say when William Kemp admitted despair as the companion of his days, and with it the lure of death. Chapter 26. Hunched in his cabin over his journal, Paris contended with sultry heat and general feelings of lassitude. In a way, these discomforts helped his resolve to complete his notes for the day. They were, together with the words themselves, details in the belated evidence of love that he was always offering to Ruth. The entries, however trivial or commonplace, had become links in a chain of communion. He spared no distressing matter, feeling that this, too, all that he was enduring on the ship, could somehow be offered to her in terms of love and contrition.
Our privileged position for trading has not lasted very long. We have now been anchored here for 10 days, and woke this morning to find 2 ships in the offing, a Frenchman and a Bristol slaver named the Edgar, whose captain Thurza was acquainted with, a man named MacDonald. The presence of the French ship put our good captain thoroughly out of temper at once. It seems that the French are notorious for paying high prices, and this because they can sell their negroes dearer in their own colonies than we can in ours. And so they ruin the trade for the English. Thurzo clenched his fists when he spoke of it, and flushed up very dark, and those strangely unprotected-looking eyes of his that I have spoke of before went glancing all over the deck, as if he hoped to find a Frenchman handy whom he could seize up to the grating and exercise his wrath upon. His deepest rages are always reserved for crosses to his will, and especially when this involves any loss in trading. I have often remarked on it, but it is nevertheless strange to hear a man abuse a whole nation, as he did the French, for several minutes on end, for popery and cowardice and poor seamanship and I know not what, when the true cause is only that they can obtain £5 a head more for their negroes than you can for yours. He seems lacking in any sort of perspective beyond commercial advantage, and without imagination for how others might see things. Barton, though I think him a wickeder man, at least in the sense of conscious wickedness, has greater perception of others, and even humour of a certain kind, as I saw once again in the matter of the muskets. These, or rather the mutilations resulting from them, lived on in my mind with some special horror, I think because of the ludicrous display the men made of them. This was so much the case with me that I took the step, unusual these days, as he and I rarely have much to say to each other, of asking the captain directly if it were true that we sold defective firearms to these people. He denied it fiercely, being, I really think, incapable of admissions that might be weakening to his commercial prospects. But Barton later told me, with a good deal of chuckling and peering about, that English slavers have for many years been including inferior goods, bought at cheaper rates from the manufacturers, in their trade cargoes, not only weapons, but metal goods generally, and textiles too. "They cheat us and we cheat them," as Barton put it. "That is the way the world goes round." I dare say it is, but I cannot help suspecting that it was we, rather than the Africans, who gave the globe its first spin in that direction. In the time we have been here, we have acquired 17 more slaves, bringing our total now to 24, of whom 8 are females. Several of them have inflammations from their burns, and I have treated them as well as I can with dressings. There's a difference in the way they are branded, the men being marked on the breast, the women on the buttocks. They have been kept mainly on deck so far, under an awning that has been rigged amidships. Tapley was punished this morning for spitting on the deck. He received 12 strokes with a rattan cane. He is the second to be caned since we came here. The other was Callie, who apparently tried to take hold of one of the women, but she set up a shriek and prevented him. He escaped the heavier punishment of flogging, as it was seen he had done no harm. It is doubtful, I think, whether he meant any. He's in some dream of his own much of the time. The woman's cry had so frightened him that he fell headlong on the deck and half knocked himself out. Thurzo had him hauled up and caned there and then, as a convenient example, with the blood still running down from a cut in his scalp.
Even thus dazed, he struggled violently, and four men were required to tie him. What the negroes think when they see their captors being thus treated, I have no means of knowing. The interpreter Thurzo threatened the men with has not yet appeared. I was told by Simmons, on whose watch it occurred, that there was an eclipse of the moon in the early hours of the morning. He says that he perceived the shade enter upon the moon's disk shortly before 4 o'clock, and it was wholly darkened by 5, soon after which he lost sight of it in the haze, it being by then very near the horizon. I was sorry not to have been present at this, as I think I have only once before seen the moon totally shaded. Captain Thurzo is not aboard at present. He has left Barton in command, with orders to keep a good watch, and to buy any likely slaves that are brought out to the ship, also to spy on the Frenchman's activities as far as possible, and has had himself rowed out to the Edgar. It seems that MacDonald is returning further eastward along the coast, and will know the situation there. Thurzo did not ask his surgeon to accompany him, for which that same surgeon is grateful. Not long after he had gone, a party of men under Haynes set off to shore in the yawl with water casks and a variety of cutting tools. What these last are for, I do not know. There is much that is not explained to me. I do not mean kept from me. I suppose my knowledge is assumed, and it would be easy to resign myself to this. Cease inquiring about this world of the present, into which I have strayed by some accident, and which appears more grievous to me every day, just as I have ceased to speculate, or much to care, about what is to become of me. Perhaps that is all that would be needed, by an act of will to relinquish curiosity, and so have no need to skulk away from God when he walks in the cool of the evening. But this, as he knew, was death in life. It was in a spirit of rebellion against his own self-abnegation that he abruptly closed his journal now and made his way up on deck. The weather was oppressively heavy and hot, with a darkening skein of cloud drawing over the sky from the distant headlands to the south. The wind had abated, but the waves were high over the bar across the river mouth. He saw the glitter of the spray and heard the low thunder of the breakers. This distant violence of the surf, viewed across the calm expanse of blue unbroken water, appeared to Paris like the stealthy release of some vindictive mania long nursed. A sickening, fetid smell came over the water from MacDonald's ship, lying to windward of them with its full cargo of slaves. Turning and looking down into the waist of the ship, he saw the negroes clustered under their canopy, their bodies patterned by shadows. The slight continuous riffling of the awning made gleaming fluxions of light on the men's chains. The women had been given a piece of calico to tie round their waists so as to cover the pudenda, and these squares of white held an intense purity in the thick light filtering down through the canvas. Johnson and Libby were standing guard, armed with pistols and whips. Forward of him, astride on the boom, he saw Hughes working on the tackle for the stay ropes, head and shoulders outlined against the sky. On the deck below, Kavanagh was sitting cross-legged, with various bits and pieces laid out before him. Paris made his way forward and stood near the starboard rail. Kavanagh had glanced up at his approach, but his eyes were back on his work now, and he showed no sign of being aware of the surgeon's proximity. They had not spoken much together since he had treated Kavanagh for an inflamed condition of the eyes. "What work is that you're doing?" the surgeon inquired after an interval of some moments. "I'm putting in new pins for these blocks." Kavanagh's voice was surprisingly soft and musical. After an appreciable pause, he added, "They have wore loose. They were not well fitted to begin with." This was the longest speech that Kavanagh had made for some considerable time, but he felt relaxed this morning, in the sultry weather, under the slowly thickening sky, with customary aggravation absent for the moment. Thurzo away on his visit, Haynes ashore with a boat party, Barton below somewhere busy with stores. Besides, though he would not have gone so far as to admit to a liking, he had formed a favourable judgment of Paris over the weeks, and this, though the surgeon had started out with a black mark against him of being related to the owner. In this, Kavanagh shared the general opinion of the forecastle. It was seen that Paris spoke fairly to people, and that he was no crimp for Thurzo. It was remembered how he had stood out against the captain over treating Wilson's torn back. Other things there were, too. A ship is a public place, and the Liverpool merchant was little more than 100 feet long from stem to stern, Paris would have been surprised to learn the extent to which his words and actions had been noted. Kavanagh maintained silence for some moments more to see if the surgeon had more questions. He discovered in himself a reluctance to let this conversation come to an end. He said, "They don't use hard enough